And if Senator Brown is crabby without eating, then I have reason to be crabby today, because we got out late from session, and I had to go directly to another meeting, and I haven't had lunch, so I'm going to be a crabby.
And Mr. Chair, I think it was made very clear, I am crabby without eating, I am crabbier without, I'm crabby with lunch, I'm crabbier without it.
Well, I'll try to, control myself. We're going to open a public hearing, I believe, on Senate Bill 646.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 646 in its printed version makes physician assistants agents of supervising licensees when performing practice-related activities. However, you have the dash one amendment, which is related to the current physician assistant mandate that says no insurer shall refuse a claim solely on the ground that the claim was submitted by a physician assistant practicing under the circumstances set forth under their statute. That's where we are.
Okay, and we have Kurt Hawkinson and Pat Kenny Moore and Marshall Cobe. Go ahead as you wish in whatever order.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. I'm Marshall Kober, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and Senate Bill 646 is our bill, and the policy of the original bill is going to go to the interim. So we have a sunsetting insurance mandate that we are going to insert into the bill instead, and with me today is Kurt Hawkinson, who can speak in more detail to that.
Thank you, Senator Fisher, members of the committee. As Mr. Cobe stated, my name is Kurt Hawkinson. I'm the immediate past president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. I practice here in Salem. We come for you today with amended Bill 646 from the Senate, of course, which basically takes care of a sunset provision in the Oregon Statute 743.725. This bill is due to sunset this year and was originally put on the books to prevent an insurer from discriminating against a claim for insurance reimbursement from a physician assistant practicing in a rural or underserved area. I won't go into greater details with this, given the fact it's been on the books for at least 12 years. I could not find anything further back in the history than that, but I would be happy to answer any questions you might have for us.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. Do you have any idea why the sunset was put in the first place?
Senator Fisher, Senator Burdick, I honestly cannot say that because I was not involved with the organization at that time. My guess would be that the sunset is what it took to make it acceptable to all parties at that time. But other than that, I can't speak to it.
You mean 12 years ago?
I believe that's correct, ma'am.
And how many, follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
How many times has the sunset been extended?
Senator Fisher, Senator Burdick, I believe that this is the second extension for this, but I cannot quote that for sure.
Did you have lunch?
Well, I'm just wondering why we need to extend the sunset if it's a cool deal and it's been in for 12 years. I'm just wondering why we need to have another sunset. Why don't we just make it a law? I mean, you can change a law.
Senator Fisher, Senator Burdick, certainly that would be fine with us. We have just come back to reaffirm what is already on the books, essentially.
You raised a good question. Did you have comments?
No, I think Mr. Hawkinson covered what I was planning on adding to that.
Senator Fisher, if I may, certainly we would be open to removing the sunset from this completely and not having to come back and see you again in 6 years and waste your valuable time on this.
Get rid of it. It's been in 12 years.
How quick can we get one? Can we get an amendment by Monday?
We could certainly try to get an amendment for Monday. You have Monday and Wednesday meetings.
Do you have any objection to do that?
No.
They won't let us do a line item.
I
I won't.
Okay, I guess we could go ahead with that.
So, Mr. Chair, that. Members of the committee, what you want me to do is just delete the sunset altogether. Is that the amendment that you want to have? I believe that's the understanding of the committee chair,
anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
We'll do it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Do you want to stay here? I imagine it seems like we have about in reverse the same names for the next bill. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 646 and open the public hearing on 647.
Again, good afternoon, Chair Fisher and members. I'm Marshall Kobo, representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants on Senate Bill 647. We thank you for this opportunity to discuss the -2 amendments to the bill. Our last hearing, there were some concerns raised by our friends at the OMA, and we've worked with them and the Board of Medical Examiners, and their language is included in both. They both had suggested language, and that is both included in the -2 amendments. We also have the -1 amendments that we had brought originally for the original hearing that also we would ask be adopted. So we would ask today that the -1 and -2 amendments be adopted. With me today is Pat Kenny Moore, who can speak to the amendments specifically in more detail.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Moore.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Fisher and members of the committee. As the president-elect of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, I wanted to thank the committee for your patience as we work through some of the negotiations between the organization, the OMA, as well as the BME. We think the time was well spent, and we do believe that the language that we have in front of us today is agreeable. We had an organizational meeting a week or so ago where members of the OSPA around the state were very much in favor of the wording as it currently stands. We appreciate the time that we've been allowed to come to this agreement and look forward to improving our opportunity to provide health care to patients around the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone that wishes to testify further on this bill, on the amendments? Seeing none, hearing no questions from the committee. Senator Bridge.
Is it your understanding, I see in the back of the room, that the OMA is on board with these? I see nods. So. And the Board of Medical Examiners.
That was my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. We have a nod in the affirmative from representatives of the OMA.
And the BME.
I will close the public hearing now and go to a work session on Senate Bill 647.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 647.
Can we do them individually? Senator Morissette has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 647. Any discussion? Objection? Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Pardo?
Aye.
Senator
Dorr?
Aye.
Senator
Morissette?
Aye. Senator Fisher? Aye. Motion carries. Mr. Chair, I would move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 647.
As amended by the
day. Amended by the -1 amendments.
Senator Morissette moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 647 as amended by the -1 amendment. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Pardo?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 647 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 647 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, is there further discussion? Any objections? And seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Pardo?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. I wonder, should we ask Senator Farioli? It's his bill.
Good idea.
I think we'll let Senator Farioli carry this bill, and the bill is passed as amended. Motion is passed as amended, I guess. And we're going to have to... We have a little change in schedule for some reason or another. LC wasn't able to get the amendments done on 885, so we don't have it for today.
That was my bad.
Well, I'm not interested in any chastising statements today, so we'll just work on it. We'll just work on it Monday. I don't think there's problems with it. It shouldn't take very long.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain some self-flagellation? Okay. Sorry about that.
I'm going to open a public hearing then on Senate Bill 891.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as printed, Senate Bill 891 modifies the licensing qualifications for physical therapists and physical therapist assistants. You do have a dash 2 amendment that will be presented by Stephen Kapori, and it makes some extensive changes to the bill.
Okay. Mr. Kapori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kapori.
At all.
I'm here representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I have with me today Ricky Sesek, who is a physical therapist and the head of physical therapy at Providence Hospital, and Kathy Zarazinski, who is also a physical therapist and is chair of the Physical Therapy Licensing Board. If you would pay attention to the dash 2 amendments, please, and throw the original bill and the dash 1 amendments away, I would be appreciative. This is what we will be presenting today for your approval. And we have a total rewrite of the Physical Therapy Licensing Act. Ms. Sesek is going to go through the policy issues that are in the bill, and Ms. Zarazinski will go through the other sections so that you know what's in the bill that's more technical in nature.
Senator Fisher and members of the committee, I'm Ricky Sesek, past president of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. Sorry for all of the confusion on our bill, but what we really were trying to do originally, several years ago, the Federation of State Boards, Licensing Boards of Physical Therapy came up with what they called Model Practice Act language, which chapters of the American Physical Therapy Association decided to try and adopt throughout the United States so that we could get our language in our various licensing statutes more consistent. And we would be using the same words and kind of having the same kinds of things throughout the United States. So a lot of us went ahead and, using the Model Practice Act as a template, changed our licensing statutes to meet that. A lot of other states have done it too. So some of it, even though it seems like a big change, some of it and a lot of it is really the same. It's just some different language so we can get more consistent. There are some things in there that are significant changes to current policy. And those are, I wanted to bring up three of those today. One, some of you may be aware of that we've talked to you in the past about, is we want to delete the 30-day limit on direct access. In 1993, the legislature passed a bill for direct access, which means that a client can come to a physical therapist without a referral from a physician. Our compromise in order to get the bill passed was that a 30-day limit was put on that, so that if a person comes to a physical therapist, say for a back problem, we're treating them. If this magic 30 days come, they're doing fine, their treatment's going well, they have to go see a doctor. We feel that that's not necessary. It's arbitrary. It adds costs to health care, and it also delays people's treatment sometimes while they're waiting to get into the doctor, etc. We feel that people in the state can go see a chiropractor, a physician, a massage therapist, an athletic trainer, a personal trainer, an occupational therapist, a psychologist, a speech therapist. They can see everybody without a referral, without, you know, that kind of a restriction that, oh, you're going to meet this number of days, you're going to have to go see someone else. Our current law and this law does require us, anytime no matter when it is, maybe it's day one, maybe it's day two, maybe it's day 30, that a patient is not responding to our treatment or is not a candidate for physical therapy, or we feel that their problem is outside of our scope of practice, our law already requires us to refer them to another provider or to the appropriate provider, and we do that all the time. We'll get a physician-referred patient or a direct access patient. We do an evaluation. We say, you really need to see, you know, a doctor. We'll refer them back for other tests and things if we really think it's something that doesn't fit our practice. So that's one of the things. The other thing is the protection of the term physical therapy and physiotherapy. Currently, we have no protection of those terms, so anybody, including yourselves, could say that you do physical therapy. So you'll see a lot of advertising of various kinds of clinicians, or you'll go into an office where there'll be a room that's called the physical therapy room. And we feel that patients in particular assume that they're being treated by a physical therapist when they go to these kinds of clinics, when in fact they could be treated by a medical assistant or just about anybody else. And we feel like if somebody says that they're providing physical therapy, then it should be provided by a physical therapist or someone who is under the jurisdiction of the state physical therapy licensing board and under the laws that regulate physical therapy in this state. And so we feel that that is a protection of the public issue. So we would like to protect those terms. The third thing is we are asking our...
Please indicate, we just got these amendments a very, very short time ago and have not had a chance to go through them and study them. Could you tell us what pages, or do you know that yourself?
I was going to say, me too.
where we can find the...
We're going to find it. And also, Steve has asked us to provide you all, Kathy and I, after this, with a copy, with a paragraph by paragraph or section by section explanation of what these things are, because we did run into some time issues getting this bill out. Under Section 10, there's some language in there that is the protection of the term physical therapy and physiotherapy. That's on page 9. Currently, the designation PT and DPT, those sorts of things, are protected even in our current law. In other words, someone can't say they are a physical therapist or put PT after their name without being a licensed physical therapist. But anybody can say they provide physical therapists as long as they, therapy, as long as they don't say, I'm a physical therapist.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think we've had a discussion on personal trainers. What do personal trainers put after their name?
Okay. Well, some of them have been known to put PT after their name, and we try not to, you know, when we see that, we have tried to deal with that through our licensing board, but they do that. We usually will, if we see it, go up and tell them, you know, or go to the gym where they're at and say, you can't really use those initials.
They have no legal right to use that.
No.
Even though they are PT.
No. Some of them will put CPT, and I think that's a certified personal trainer. And again, that is confusing, I think, to people also. But, you know, people will do just about anything.
We'll deal with that next
time. I apologize again for not having the exact citations of where these are in the law. Should I go on, Senator Fisher, with my third thing? Okay. My third thing is that one of the things that we want to do in our new bill is ask our state licensing board to develop some rules that will ensure continued competencies of physical therapists in the state of Oregon. And what we're going to recommend as a physical therapy association is some mandatory continuing education requirements, which physical therapists and physical therapist assistants do not have at this time. So that will be a big change for our licensees and change in our bill, but we feel that it's necessary.
Now, excuse me, Senator
Morsant.
Sure.
What page is that on? No, she can tell us what page we're looking at.
I can't go with section.
Oh, she can't tell us what page. That's okay. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, too.
I thought you... Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, we just received these amendments this morning. I've been working on this bill draft since last September, and it's been An unholy mess.
I guess I thought as long as you gave us the notation for the first part, you had a list of notations.
We have just seen this bill for the first time in terms of, I know all the language and I can quote it to you by heart. It's just the placing of different things and all those things. So we're familiar with the issues. Exact placement, we're not at this point. We'll have it to you.
We've already lost two senators. That's not a good sign, I don't think. I do have, and I forgot to give you this, written testimony for what I'm saying at this moment that would maybe be helpful if you want to give that to them. And we will try and get a little more clear on what the sections of the bill are. We had a little trouble getting our bill drafted, so we're shooting from the hip a little bit. So I guess what, in closing, what I want to say is that, you know, physical therapy has grown and developed over the years, and our programs now, including our Pacific University program in Forest Grove, are now DPT programs, which is a doctorate in physical therapy. And we just feel like we need to update our practice laws to reflect current practice in physical therapy and the current educational and training that our therapists get. So we're hoping that once you understand this bill and actually get a good explanation of it, which is Senate Bill 891, that you will allow us to have this and to pass the bill so that we'll have consistent, up-to-date language, which truly reflects what the kind of health care that physical therapists provide for citizens in this state. Thank you.
I will. Somebody
else has a question. Go ahead,
ma'am. Senator Fisher and committee members, my name is Kathy Zarzynski. I'm a physical therapist and the current chair of the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board. And I'm going to primarily direct my comments to some of the things in this bill that will protect the public, since the licensing board function is to regulate physical therapy and to protect the public. I will get to you what section, I don't know what section in the new bill these things are, but we will get that to you this week, no problem. One of the things that this bill does is requires the board to report disciplinary action to a national data bank. There is a federal requirement for that, but there is no state requirement for that. That's an excellent idea. It should be done. This bill also allows, as Ricky pointed out, other practitioners to provide care. It doesn't prohibit them from providing care, but they can't call what they do physical therapy. We do get some inquiries from, the board does get inquiries from citizens regarding, is this physical therapy when it's done here, when it's done there? I think the public does need to know that when there's a sign that says physical therapy, an advertisement that says physical therapy, or someone says I'm doing physical therapy, that they are a physical therapist, a PTA, or an individual who is being supervised by one of those two individuals and is under the jurisdiction of the licensing board. We have no jurisdiction over individuals who are not licensed by the PT board. There's a new section that allows physical therapists who are touring with a dance company or an athletic team, or is a physical therapist who's from another state that is teaching a course, to do so within a 60-day limitation without having to apply for a license. And I feel that that's very appropriate. These therapists tour with these teams or these troops, and you know, a perfect example is an NBA team that comes into Portland that has a physical therapist on their staff. That person can legally come in with them, work on the team members while they're here, and leave town without applying to the Oregon board for any licensure. It also
on the bottom of page 8 and top of page 9 for those that are watching that.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. And it also allows therapists who are licensed in other states to come in and teach. And also, if the course program calls for them to do a demonstration with a patient, that they may legally be able to do that. This bill also allows the board to discipline a licensee if they've been convicted of a crime in any state or have a substance abuse problem that may affect their ability to practice safely. Right now, the board has difficulty disciplining anyone who does anything that isn't directly related to a complaint involved in the actual practice of physical therapy. And there are situations where the person may have committed a crime not while performing physical therapy or working as a therapist, but that may jeopardize the safety of the public. And this bill will offer the board the opportunity to discipline those individuals.
page, Elo.
This bill also allows the board to hold individuals licensed under this law accountable to a nationally recognized code of ethics. And I think the recommendation will be in the rules to hold every licensee to the code of ethics of the American Physical Therapy Association. Currently, now, only members are actually held to that code of ethics by their association. There's nothing in the licensing law that refers to a code of ethics, and I think that's a major step for us. This bill also requires a corporation, insurance company, healthcare organization, healthcare facility, or a state or local government agency, or any person licensed by the board to report any conviction or violation of this act. Right now, it is only required of a person licensed by this act to report. And we feel that there have been situations that have come up where in another part of the state, the board is located in Portland, someone has been convicted of a crime that's licensed by our board. We don't know about it unless someone files a complaint. This would require courts, the court system, the court system to notify us if a therapist gets convicted. That's, I think, very important in protecting the public. And a stronger provision in this bill would require that anyone who has a direct or indirect financial investment or who will derive financially from a physical therapy facility, i.e., an example I will use is if a physician owns a physical therapy practice, that physician must notify a patient in writing before the patient sees the therapist that they have an ownership in this facility and may derive direct or indirect compensation from this facility. The law requires that. It's quite watered down now, and I think this is very important because we've had some complaints where patients have told us that their physician would write them orders for therapy only if they went to the facility that the physician owned. This particular patient had seen another therapist, wanted to go back to that therapist who did not work in the physician's office. The physician did not give this patient orders for therapy. So we feel that it's important that the consumer know and that they can make a choice. It may not matter at all to some people, but it may matter a great deal to others, and I feel this is important. With this information, a consumer can make an informed decision about where they will receive their care. Those are the highlights, I think, of the bill that add to patient protection. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add two comments, if I might. The committee has no further questions. One is there's one other issue in here that we thought was not controversial but may turn out to be controversial. I wanted to bring that to your attention. And that is the issue of the number of people on the board. Right now, and make up the board, we have a physician member prescribed by statute to be on the board. And we think we've grown up now. That may have been a good idea in the 20s or the 30s whenever physical therapy started, but we're a grown-up profession and we don't need somebody holding our hand. Other licensing licensed professions, nurses, chiropractors, don't have doctors on their boards, and we don't see there's any benefit. It's not a major issue. It's not that we have problems having a doctor on the board. It's just it's symbolic issue to us, and we had our druthers, we would have the board made of physical therapists and public members. The other thing is I want to...
May I ask a question about that?
Yes, Senator Morse.
On the 30-day rule, does the physician on your board support that you don't have to send someone to the... Is that why you're getting rid of the physician on your
board? No, the current... Senator Morse, I have not had that conversation with the physician member. I have asked him how he felt about the physician being removed from the board. He said that he was enjoying serving on the board, but he didn't think a physician was necessary. Mm-hmm. But the two are not related.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask.
Mr. Chair, the other thing I wanted to say, I wanted to thank Chris Green, who is the drafter who worked on this. He was very patient and been working under a lot of time stresses, and I kept coming back to him and working with him over and over and over again on this bill. It got into the process quite late, and he's done a marvelous job of being patient with us and working hard to get this bill in front of you.
Okay, so noted. By way of information, several of the boards do have still members of different professions sitting on them. For instance, the Board of Nursing Home Examiners has a doctor, nurse, and pharmacist on their board. And I know at least one other board, I believe the Board of Chiropractic has a doctor, a medical doctor on their board.
Mr. Chair, there may be an instance here or there, but most of the licensing boards don't anymore.
Okay. Yes, Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I guess this is for Stephen or Ricky. The 30-day limit. Is that, did the docs wanted that for the insurance companies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, this has nothing to do with insurance. This bill is totally irrelevant of any insurance regulations. If an insurance company wants to require five doctors to view somebody before they go to physical therapist, that's their business. We're only talking about the legal requirement of the licensure. I'm sorry, your question was?
Who's imposing
the... Oh, what happened when we passed the bill, the Medical Association had fought against any kind of direct access for years, and when we finally passed the bill in 1993, there was a compromise made at that time to get the bill out. We thought it was unnecessary, but it's something you had to have. As you well know, sometimes you accept things that you don't like in your statutes in order to get a bill through, and we did that. We've been monitoring since that time, and we haven't found any problems that required that. We've looked at other states that don't have it, that have no limitation at all, and we actually have looked at malpractice claims in other states. There's been a statewide or national study done, and there is no evidence of any problems occurring where there is no 30-day requirement or where there's any direct access requirement. Did you want to say any more?
No. I was going to bring up that part, that we do have some research about direct access.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll may I ask the next shoe to drop. Is there no opposition from the AMA right now?
We have more testimony.
Oh, we're going to have more testimony.
Okay. Senator Morse.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Scott Gallant.
I didn't look at the list.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. And like you, I received what is a fairly substantive change of the original bill this afternoon and have just essentially been reading the provisions of the legislation as you've been talking to the previous speakers on the issue. The bill, as described, and I think in a very quick review of the proposal, does make some very substantive changes, not only in the relationship about a 30-day referral issue itself, but in the apparent addition of a new type of physical therapist aid, which is new. The definition of what the practice of physical therapy means is quite different from the existing statute and warrants, I think, some more serious thought and consideration of what that may mean in actual practice. And I certainly have not had an opportunity to do that yet, but It does talk about examining, evaluation, and treating of mechanical and physiological developmental impairments, et cetera, health and movement-related conditions in order to determine a diagnosis, a prognosis, and a plan of intervention to assess ongoing effects of therapeutic intervention. Therapeutic intervention, diagnosis, and prognosis are very sensitive terms, depending on how you apply them, at least in the medical world. It may be different in the physical therapy world. But, you know, we would obviously have to look at that and see what it means. And there are additional changes beyond that in the definition as well, which I think the committee should, you know, have an opportunity to really have an assessment of what kind of impact it may have. The section regarding the referral piece, I understand that it is something that has been under the craw of physical therapists for quite some time, and that we, you know, just simply disagree. Our position has always been that there is a legitimate reason to have patients medically evaluated to determine whether or not pain that is caused in joints or soft tissue or otherwise might in fact be the cause of an underlying illness.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Finish your sentence. Or
I'll stop.
Scott, I guess I'm probably as conservative of any of the members on this panel in terms of scope of practice issues. But I'm assuming that same person could go to an acupuncturist or a chiropractor without this 30-day referral and still have the same underlying medical issues. So why would it be different for a physical therapist than it would be for an acupuncturist or a chiropractor? And maybe my assumption is wrong, but that's, I mean...
I think you can make that case of whether or not that policy would override at least an opportunity to make a determination for children or children athletes or others that might have underlying medical illnesses that are not simply physical therapy problems. It's a legitimate choice you may make. The medical association's view is that it is smarter to be cautious.
Okay.
For the benefit of the patient or the student athlete, the child or the elderly, in trying to determine whether or not the actual problem may in fact be an underlying illness.
Okay. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Senator Brown.
I guess if your concerns were warranted or had validity, one would assume that malpractice rates for physical therapists would be high or higher than the medical community. And I don't know that this is the case, is it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I don't think you can necessarily make that connection.
Okay.
And the reason is quite often physical therapists are employees of physicians or hospitals.
Okay.
And any litigation might, as a matter of fact, go to the employer rather than the person who provided the physical therapy.
Okay. Thanks.
If that answers your question, Senator. You might also note, as I'm sure you all have, that... or may not have had an opportunity to have. Under 688.132, there is a provision that statute that does, in fact, say that PIP coverage, injury protection benefits, are not required to be paid for by physical therapy treatment of a person covered by the applicable insurance policy unless the person is referred to the physical therapist by a licensed physician, podiatric physician, surgeon, naturopathic physician, etc. So there is a a insurance component to this, again, at a very quick reading, that there may be others who are, in fact, interested in reviewing that and determining what kind of impact that might have in that process. The issue, and I'm not sure the bill really addresses this, but the issue of whether someone can say that they are actually providing physical therapy and having a statute that, I mean, the actual provision of physical therapy could be problematic. We, you know, do have orthopedic physicians, some who are also capable of providing physical therapy, or who employ and train individuals for the provision of physical therapy as an employer and are responsible for that from a liability and practice standard. So that we need to consider what implication that may have, most certainly on physicians and how that would play out. Let's see if I can. In regard to the comment about growing up and not having a position on the physical therapy board, I would think that actually the input of a physician in this arena would be a benefit not only to the board but to the public. But again, that is a policy choice members may wish to take. Quite often, in my experience, at least where boards have chosen to consolidate and have maybe a narrower view of the world, the rulemaking process and the authority of that board to determine the actual scope and services that may be provided under the terms of the change in the statute can be quite different than I would have expected from the language of the statute. That may sound like, again, being overly cautious, but I have seen that happen where we have been in other disagreements or had concerns over other scopes of practice. Optometry and ophthalmology comes to mind, for example, and there are clearly others over the past. So it's not quite as simple, I think, as one might assume. My experience also with uniform bills is that most states consider them, modify them, reject some portions, adopt kind of variations of them, and so you, in essence, have different statutes and changes between states. It's very unusual to have a uniform bill that is actually adopted uniformly across the country. So I don't know that really, you know, is the basis necessarily for adopting this exact language. And I've not had a chance to review the uniform bill to see if, in fact, that is, you know, exactly what is presented to the committee. I'll stop there. What I would ask the committee, actually, is to give the Medical Association, maybe other organizations, an opportunity to have a real evaluation of the bill and its impact and implications. Thank you for your time.
Scott, do you know there's a couple of provisions in here that I'm concerned with? See on page 12. About mid-page, line 15, excuse me. It has the authority to conduct an investigation at any time on its own initiative without receipt of a written complaint. The board has reason to believe that there may have been a violation of sections 1 to 16 of this 2003 Act. Do you know if the Board of Medical Examiners has, for instance, anything of that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I suspect that the board, in fact, does have the authority to initiate its own investigation, but I, again, it's probably old age, but I suspect that it is based off of some complaint or information. There's a basis for the initiation of the board. This provides none other than the board may initiate one. You know, you may... I'll look at that statute and see what the language is.
And also E down on line 20, starting on line 22, impose any other appropriate sanction, including assessing the cost of the proceedings, the civil penalty. Costs may include but are not limited to the cost of investigation, attorney's fees, hearing officer costs, and the cost of discovery. That's pretty healthy.
Mr. Chairman, that is. It could be very expensive and, you know, again, just off the cuff. It could be a barrier for a licensee to contest a sanction or penalty.
It certainly wouldn't have any restricting effect on the board if they could do that to make a timely or reasonably costed investigation.
It could be very expensive.
I don't recall these particular wordings in a lot of the board.
Mr. Chairman, I don't either.
Okay, questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Diana Godwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice, and for the past, about 18 years, I have been an attorney for a number of physical therapy clinics in independent practice, I mean clinics that are owned by physical therapists. I presently represent a group of about 100 clinics throughout the state, and all of my members, all of my 100 clinics, do have certification to see patients without referral from a doctor. And to my knowledge, and I work very, very closely with them on any issues that might involve any complaints about them, there have been no problems. I will need you to keep in mind that when a physical therapist chooses to treat a patient who comes in without a prior doctor's referral, the physical therapist is very, very cautious. For one thing, most of the physical therapist's business still comes and will continue to come from physicians. They work very closely with physicians. They're part of the team. Physical therapists have always been part of traditional medicine, and almost all of their patients still come from referral from MDs. So you can imagine and trust that if that physical therapist is treating patients inappropriately who've come to them directly without doctor's referral, if they fail to diagnose them appropriately, if they treat them too long, if they don't get them back to a doctor whenever they see anything that's outside their scope of practice or any problem that they don't feel is appropriate for physical therapy, their reputation with their referring doctors would be harmed. And so they don't do it. They act very, very cautiously. In fact, I have been an independent practice patient myself on three occasions. I've had tendonitis in each of my two elbows. It was from overuse and gardening, and I had a canoeing. I've strained at canoeing. So I've gone in myself a couple of times to see a physical therapist without a doctor's referral. It was less expensive for my insurance company, or I paid it out of pocket. It was very appropriate, very helpful. The physical therapist is very cautious in evaluating my problem, and it works really well. In fact, just last fall, I went back for a strain in my iliotibia band. I had iliotibia band syndrome, and they worked with me, got the inflammation down, gave me stretching exercises, very cost-effective and very helpful. So what this bill will do is eliminate that requirement for the patient to go back to the doctor after 30 days. In the case of my iliotibia band syndrome, I treated for about a month, and then I got a referral because I needed a couple of extra extra treatments to make sure that inflammation was under control. So we did that. I worked real closely with my orthopedist, so there was no problem, as did my physical therapist. I did want to address Senator Brown's question earlier to Mr. Gallant about, or actually I wanted to address Mr. Gallant's response, I think, on one of Senator Brown's questions about concern about kids in school settings not getting proper evaluation. Well, we have had long on the books ORS 688132, subsection B, A, and large A and B, which says that the 30-day rule does not apply if the individual is a child or student eligible for special education and is being seen pursuant to the child or student's individual education plan or individual family service plan, or the student is a student athlete at a public or private school, college, or university and is seeking treatment in that role as an athlete. So there hasn't been a problem with that. That's already been an exception in the law, that students are not subject to that 30-day rule. I also work with a lot of physical therapists who have issues before the licensing board, and I particularly wanted to talk to Senator Fisher's questions about concerns about the new procedures for the board to have additional disciplinary authority, particularly that question of conducting an investigation at any time on its own initiative. In fact, I just finished representing a physical therapist in a complaint before the licensing board where the board brought the complaint on its own initiative and without disclosing any names or, you know, private details. I will tell you that what happens is the board is investigating another complaint. They receive a complaint from a citizen. In the course of that investigation, they're receiving records. They've noticed that another physical therapist who might have been involved had done something inappropriate. And in that case, the board followed up with that therapist as well. That was not the therapist about whom the complaint was made. So, and I can't imagine a licensing board, when they see something on their own in the course of looking into an issue, that would want to just ignore it, because the role of the board is to protect the public. And while it would have been nice for my particular client not to have been subjected to that, it's a perfectly appropriate authority for any medical licensing board in their role to protect the public. But as to the issue of imposing other sanctions, including cost of investigation, attorney fees, hearing officer, yeah, we may want to take a little look at that. I do represent individual physical therapists, and that could be a significant impediment to somebody wanting vigorously to defend themselves.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Diana, just to follow up on that, as I read page 13 again, we just got the bill as well.
Sure.
My understanding is that it sort of gives a prescriptive list of what the board can do in terms of the following disciplinary mm-hmm. actions, which look really appropriate to me, but you know, I'm a lawyer, so I have the bar breathing down my neck all the time. So I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming that C is further modified by page 13, subsection 3, but I don't know.
I think that's an issue. And this list under 3, I was able to read through the whole thing before I came up, and that's exactly the list of sanctions that they can impose today under the current law.
Okay. So. And
well, let's, Senator Brown.
Just other questions.
Are you talking about 13G then?
No, the board may take the following disciplinary actions singly or in combination against any licensee who's violated sections 1 through 16. Revoke a license, suspend a license, refuse to issue. I think that's the sanctions that they're talking about in subsection 1C. I'm sorry, subsection E.
Mm-hmm.
So, but.
Well, yeah, I see that, but it says including assessing the cost of the proceedings as a civil penalty.
And that was sort of my follow. I assume that other disciplinary boards have similar ability to go after costs and fees. I mean, I'm assuming the Board of Medical Examiners has that. I assume the Nursing Board has that.
No,
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I I would like to work okay. with the proponents of the bill on okay. if there's any of those kinds of issues.
Okay.
But, because I agree with you, we do have that power under E, but it's not reiterated under subsection 3.
Mr. Chair, and then a follow-up.
Yes.
And Diana, you may not be familiar. What is the in terms of the clinicians you work with, what is the percentage of women to men in terms of that population?
Actually, quite a few. And, in fact, I'm very gratified to see that a number of women physical therapists have started their own businesses. They don't just work as employees. I work for a number of the clinics that are part of my group are owned by women physical therapists, a couple of women partners. In fact, Ms. Zarazinski is in charge of her own clinic, who was just up here testifying. So it's very gratifying, and we're seeing more and more of it. Heads of departments owning their own businesses, very successful.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Senator Brown, years ago in the early 70s, I talked to a physical therapist that was on my staff that was also a nurse, and she wanted to get into physical therapy. We had a room. We couldn't really afford to go into it ourselves and have the whole room, so I said, why don't you work it out? I'll work out a deal to rent with you. She went home and came back the next day and said, my husband won't let me.
Oh, wow. Well.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So I'm glad to see that at least some husbands are getting a little less recalcitrant from you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good to see you.
Marcia Keith.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith with Dave Barrels and Associates, here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And I can see the puzzled looks on your faces. I have just had a chance to look at the amendments as the rest of you have, so it may be that the issue I'm about to raise is a non-issue, but I need to raise it. It has been an issue in the past between veterinarians and the physical therapists about the scope of the physical therapist practice relative to animals. In the old statutory language, it was clear that physical therapists were licensed to work on human beings. In this language, the practice of physical therapy, which is beginning to be defined on page 24, line 24, page 1, and goes through the rest of section 1 over on page 2, eliminates any reference to human beings. Therefore, the old issue surfaces between the physical therapists and the veterinarians, and I would like to have some time to work with the veterinarians to see what their comfort level is with this language. My early discussion with them very quickly on the phone in the hall 2 minutes ago seemed to imply that they were not comfortable now with the language. So I would just like to register that concern. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wanted to respond to we had this discussion last session. There are some animal owners and some veterinarians who think there's benefits to physical therapy for their animals, especially expensive racehorses and fancy dogs that sometimes get hip problems, for example. It's not our intention as physical therapists to usurp the role of veterinarian. The veterinarian's law is very clear right now. We cannot operate on animals, deal with animals in physical therapy without a veterinarian doing the initial assessment and being in charge of the animal. And nothing we could pass in this law, we could not pass in this law that's going to change that, and we're not attempting to. However, we did want to take the words human being out, so in those situations where a veterinarian wants to, or an owner wants to have a physical therapist work on that animal under the supervision of a veterinarian, that we would be within our scope of practice in doing so. So I don't think there's a conflict, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I, yes. if I could just clarify one more thing. The chiropractors and the veterinarians have a similar referral relationship, and language in the chiropractic scope of practice makes it clear that a chiropractor must practice chiropractic on an animal under the referral of a veterinarian. That is in the chiropractor's scope of practice. The only reference to the relationship between a veterinarian and a physical therapist, if human being is taken out of this language, is in the Veterinarian's Scope of Practice Act, which doesn't really enable veterinarians to go after a physical therapist. The chiropractors can go after their chiropractors because they're enabled to in their Scope of Practice Act. But without any language in the Physical Therapist Act, we still have our concern.
Okay. Well, I think there's several things that we need to look over, and obviously all of us need a little more time to study this fairly major work here. Too bad we didn't get it a couple months earlier. We could have spent a little more time on it wouldn't have crowded things quite so quickly, so we'll proceed cautiously and see what we can do here. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 891 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2021.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2021, as printed, decreases from $1 million to $250,000 the amount of capital surplus required by healthcare service contractors furnishing dental service or optometrical service. However, we have the Dash 2 amendment, which replaces that measure that you heard on the 31st of March. The Dash 2 amendments also resolve conflicts that came up with what was Senate Bill 353 and has been enrolled and is now Oregon Laws, Chapter 33. Anyway, Holly Robinson is here to talk to you about the conflict amendment.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Holly Robinson, Legislative Council. I've worked in this building on and off since 1988, and trying to explain conflict amendments is always a challenge, but in this case, hopefully it will be easy. House Bill 2021, the Dash 2 amendments that you're going to be considering, amends a temporary provision of Oregon law that was passed last session, and that is Section 5, Chapter 318, Oregon Laws 2001. At the time that piece of legislation was passed, and this is really where it gets not only boring, but you understand some of the idiosyncrasies of our jobs, the phrase, to qualify for authority to transact insurance in this state on or after the effective date of this 2001 act was how the language shows up in the bill. And if you look at the Dash 2 amendments, which I don't have, but on line 2, you'll see the words bracketed out, the effective date of this 2001 act. Well, because consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, in Senate Bill 353, which has already passed this body, our office replaced the phrase on or after the effective date of this 2001 act with the phrase January 1, 2002, which was the date in fact that this was in fact the effective date of this 2001 act. As you go through the rest of the bill, it says the day before the effective date, and in the way that it was done in the in Senate Bill 353, we replaced the phrase the day before the effective date of this act as being December 31st in certain places, and we took out the entire phrase and put in January 1st on other days. So the intent of the amendments is to just get the dates of when the last set of laws went into effect. And a bottom line is our office did it one way in one bill. We did it another way in the other bill. The bottom line is they both were the same date. It was both January 1, 2002 or December 31st, 2001. But we got there in two different ways initially. And the purpose of the conflict amendments is to follow the path of least resistance in this case, which is to use the same dates that we used in Senate Bill 353 because that's already passed and been enacted into law. It's not a substantive change. It's just our office had made a judgment call, and we made the same judgment call two ways in the beginning, but now we want the dates to line up, and they are only the dates as they are reflected in temporary law as to when a temporary law or when certain provisions became effective. So you can either say the day before January 1st. I mean, you can either say it one or two ways, but the bottom line is we just have to get the dates straight, and that's what the conflict amendments do.
Now, the Dash 1 amendments, are they included in the conflict amendments?
The substantive amendments that were requested are, in fact, the Dash 1s are, in fact, incorporated in the Dash 2s.
All right, so the Dash 1 is superfluous and no longer.
That's correct.
It's a moot.
Okay. Correct. The Dash 2s can be recycled. The Dash 1s can be recycled.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brewer.
We have Dash 2 amendments, which are a combination of this fascinating conflict resolution process.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
Truly fascinating. And also the substantive amendments.
That's correct.
They're all combined.
Okay. Correct.
Thank you.
What you don't see in the Dash 2s are the underlying provisions of Senate Bill 353. Those were not pertinent to this. The only thing that was pertinent in the conflict amendments was changing the date to either the day before January, to make the dates line up, and so that's what all they thought they do. And I think that former Representative Hayden is here to talk actually about the substantive piece of the Dash 2s.
Joel Ariel and Mike Dewey.
Mr. Chair, if you prefer to have Dr. Hayden first, since he's his proponent, they're his amendments, so we would be happy to come up after he speaks. It's your preference, Mr. Chair.
Well, I did. Yeah, I just taken as you signed up. I guess I don't particularly have a preference. I'll ask. Okay, I was going to say I'll give you a before and after. Before and after, if you wish.
Maybe if we're all up here together, it might be.
All right. Have you all had dinner?
No, I have not had lunch yet. So.
Neither have I.
Probably most of you either, right? Keeps you awake.
Go ahead and come on up, Cedric. We'll work on this thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Ariel. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's good to have a friend.
I think you're more knowledgeable of some of these things than we are, and you're going to have to do a little education here for us, Cedric.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We will deal today, with your permission, with the Dash 2 amendments and consider those the essence of the bill. What I would urge the committee and the legislature to do is to take another look at a situation, a look back. The Dash 2 amendments make no change in the fiscal outline found in statute or the temporary Oregon laws. There have been two major changes since the law was since the 2001 law was passed, that I think would warrant us looking back and maybe taking another look at what we're doing here. In one situation, as you know, this bill deals with insurance for the smaller providers of health care. Since this bill passed, 250,000 people have been released or will be released by the state of Oregon who will no longer be providing dental care. Someone needs to step into that gap. Someone needs to take care of those positions. The statistics that I've had are that over 500,000 people in Oregon have no dental insurance. That was before the Oregon Health Plan stopped providing dental care. Now probably about 750,000 to 1 million people will no longer have dental care. That's one. The second new thing that's happened that warrants a look back is that this legislative session has added complementary health care service contractors to those who can serve the public and develop insurance companies. That includes chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists. These people will be wanting to come into the market also. So the Dash 2 amendments are conflict amendments, as Holly Robinson pointed out to you, that merge, in a sense, Senate Bill 353 and the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 2021. Senate Bill 353 includes complementary health care providers. This bill passed the House unanimously, and it passed the Senate unanimously, Senate Bill 353. It does not include hospitals. It's dealing with the smaller providers, the doctors, and so on. The Dash 2 amendments that are before you now, which I'll go through in a minute, allow complementary health service providers, optometrists, and dentists a period of time until December 31, 2006 to place in reserve $1 million of capital and surplus. That is a huge amount of money for an office practice to place in reserve. The insurance division and the legislature placed in temporary Oregon law a provision that that those people currently providing insurance, health insurance, to Oregonians could make installment payments. At that point in time, there were no health care service contractors of the complementary service category, so they were not included in that. Nor were dentists and optometrists included in that provision, and I will show you that in the bill in a minute. They should have been included. The complementary service providers are not eligible for the installment payment now because they missed that cutoff date of January 1, 2002. That Holly Robinson spoke about. So the Dash 2 amendments would do a very simple thing. It would allow a look back. It will say, in view of the changing circumstances, do we still want to require complementary health care providers, dentists and optometrists, who operate very low-risk practices to come up with $1,550,000 in capital and reserves, where on December 31, 2001, the requirement was $50,000. That is a 3,000% increase in one day. I can't imagine the legislature allowing anybody in the private sector to make that kind of an increase. The Dash 2 amendments are fair to small providers. It's fair to small business. It's good for consumers because it allows the possibility of more providers to take care of these 750,000 people that have no insurance and the possibility of lower premiums. Existing companies have the reserves, and they made those reserves when the capital requirements were lower. They made them then. They have them now. They will say, everybody that comes into the field now must have the same amount of reserves that we do. We don't think that's fair. We think there should be a provision for small business, which was written into Oregon law. We think there should be a provision for small business to come into the market and within a period of 3.5 years establish those reserves. We're not asking for any different financial structure. We only want the installment program that is in Oregon law. Now, Oregon statute, I won't read this whole thing to you. Oregon stat in the insurance code, Oregon statute 750.003 says, the purpose of this section is to encourage and guarantee the development of health care service contractors by licensing and regulating their operation to ensure that they provide high-quality health care services through state-licensed organizations meeting reasonable standards as to administration, services, and finally, financial soundness. I do not believe that there is any actuarial reason, I do not believe that there is any historical experience that would warrant a 3,000% increase. Nonetheless, I would accept that 3,000% increase if it were spread over 3 years, 1,000% a year. Now, the health care service contractors would not be penniless. They would still have to put on the line, the first day they get their license, $850,000. That is a 50% down payment on the $1,550,000. That would be $300,000 in capital and surplus, $500,000 in an exotic thing called additional capital and surplus, and $50,000 bond. So they would be required, all of these contractors I'm talking about would be required to come up with $850,000, which is far, far, far more than is necessary to ensure fiscal responsibility. Not only will they have $850,000, but you will notice that in ORS 750.045, subsection 5, if the Department of Consumer Business Affairs were concerned that those were not adequate reserves, they can, on their own authority, require more money. They can just say, you need the full $1,500,000. You need $3 million. They can require what they think is necessary. I believe that the status quo is a deterrent to small business. I believe it's a deterrent to providing dental care, optometric care, naturopathic care, acupuncture care to providers. I want to, if you will, please look at the Dash 2 amendments for just one moment and go to page 5 of the Dash 1 amendments. Very simply, this says that any one of the providers I've mentioned on the date that they're granted their certificate of authority can start with $850,000 or more, and that they will have the full $1,550,000 by December 31, 2006. Now, you see, if you will turn to page 3, line 29. That's
all of this stuff in bolded there under from the line 11 through 18?
Yes, sir. That's the amendment. That's the look-back amendment. Shall I proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Let's go right ahead. I just make sure I understand.
Yes. On page 3 of the Dash 2 amendments, starting with line 29 and proceeding on to page 3, you see the amounts of money that are necessary for the first phase of capital and surplus. That is, as of December 31, $300,000. It goes up $50,000 a year over the next 3 or 4 years, and a balloon payment to bring it up to $1 million of capital and surplus by December 31, 2006. Now, that's only two-thirds of the necessary money. Remember, there is something called additional capital and surplus of $500,000, which I do not believe was in the original bill of the original, in the 1999, I couldn't find it in statute. So maybe it popped up, or maybe it was there before, I don't know. And then an additional $50,000 in bonding. Going to page 2, line 6, line 26. We see that a health care service contractor that is authorized by January 2002 must possess and maintain at least the following amounts of capital, and it shows the amount of capital that they must have. It goes on to say that if they don't have it, they can use the installment plan. More than that, if they don't have it, if they don't have that money, and all of them do because they made their money before times got bad, but if they didn't have the money, according to statute, on page 3, I'm sorry, on page 4, line 28, the director can grant them an extension of time. So you see, the existing businesses have a pretty good situation. They have the opportunity of installment payments, which they assure me they don't need, but they have the opportunity for an extension of time. Any new company applying, a complementary health care provider, a dental company, an optometric company, applying after this date will not have those privileges. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would urge passage of the dash two amendments, and I thank you for your time.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ariel, Insurance Administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll be relatively brief in my comments because I think maybe questions is a better way to try to get at the issues here. But let me start by saying that I appreciate Mr. Hayden's good faith in this effort, and we've had numerous conversations and tried to work something out that would work for everybody here. So I have no question about his good faith in what he's proposing here. Where we part company is over the issue of consumer protection and what is good and not good for consumers. As insurance regulators, we think that the absolute worst thing for consumers is to have an insurer who goes insolvent without enough money to cover the promises and the money that have been collected, cover the promises, does not have enough money to cover the promises that have already been made. And when we came to the legislature in 2001, we came with a set of proposals to try to set those minimal levels of capital and surplus as low as we could, consistent with ensuring that when a healthcare service contractor went out of business, there would be enough money there to cover claims and other responsibilities. In the original legislation in 2001, that number was $2.5 million for healthcare service contractors. Recognizing some of the points that Mr. Hayden makes about how certain kinds of healthcare service contractors, what we call limited HCSCs, do not need necessarily the same amount of capital because the risk they take on is smaller. That number was cut in that bill in 2001 for dental and optometry down to $1 million. So it's only 40% of the number that everybody else has to have. So there was an explicit decision by the legislature in 2001 to say, yes, there is a category that's more limited than the normal healthcare service contractor. At that time, it included only dentistry and optometry, and at that time, the legislature's judgment and our judgment was that that appropriate number is $1 million. We think that's still the appropriate number. Now, Mr. Hayden does bring up the point that we, in that bill, recognize the transition phase for companies currently in the business. And there's a simple reason why we did that. Not because we thought it was good for the public to have people in the business at lower numbers, but if you have somebody who's already in the business, who already has obligations to consumers, then you're stuck with them. And the last thing you want to do is set some new standards that force them out of business and essentially create the problem that we're trying to avoid in the first place of a company that can't continue in business. So those numbers, to our mind, were only there for current business and not for new business. Let me trace through what kind of would happen if you allow that for new.
Let me ask you a question here. How many of those type of providers do you have?
We have zero today, Mr. Chairman. At the time the bill passed, we had one, and they have since decided, and that's what I was going to talk about now. Is
how many providers do you have under this category, period?
Oh, in the limited health care service category?
Yeah.
About a half dozen, I believe, Mr. Chairman. The one that was...
It's not a large group. It's very small.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I believe at the time the bill... Well, I know at the time the bill passed, there was one limited health care service contractor that was under the million mark. When they looked at what it would take for them to ramp up over time, they decided they couldn't do it consistent with good business practice, and so they are no longer in the market. So if we were to reintroduce this transition phase, we would be reintroducing it. We'd set, I think, a precedent for the future to introduce that kind of thing for new businesses, and we think it's not consistent with public protection. But let me explain what happens if we do allow the company in and what the company that was in face, the dilemma they face. If you come in with too little money, then sort of by definition, you don't have outside sources that you can draw on to bring the appropriate amount of capital to bear. So really, once you're in the market, your only alternative, unless somebody magically appears later with new backing for you, your only real alternative to ramp up to the numbers is to take it in premium. And if you then put that together with Mr. Hayden's arguments about how he wants to be able to provide a low-cost premium to people, you're going to run into a conflict. Because as soon as they're in the market, the only way they can get up to the levels is to have really an uncompetitive premium, a higher than normal premium, because they have to build their surplus in a way that other carriers don't. So it's kind of an untenable in business situation. And my guess is most likely, as Mr. Hayden pointed out, the language in the statute that allows existing healthcare service contractors to come and say, please give us an extension. Once someone's in the business, we're going to be hard-pressed, and they have customers out there that they're serving, hard-pressed to cut them off, so to speak. That's the last kind of decision we want to make. So we go back to the bedrock principle of what is a necessary level of capital to avoid difficult situations where consumers get hurt because a company that they put their faith in and they put their money in doesn't have the resources, and when they go insolvent, we don't have the resources to properly close it down. I'll end with that, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
You're totally discounting somebody's ability to manage a little better than somebody else, or maybe a smaller group being able to manage a little better than a larger group. Maybe being a little more frugal, maybe not perhaps purchasing downtown high-rise property and that type of an office and so forth, and then being able to get $1 million and build up to that $1 million by being a little more frugal than perhaps some of the others are.
Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mr. Dewey answer some of that in just a minute. For our purposes, I think it's a fair point that you can do business more efficiently than your competitors and gain some financial advantage. To gain, if the transition rules were applied today, there'd be a relatively small amount of capital, and to ramp that up as much as would need to be ramped up in 3 years, it would take an awful lot of that kind of financial acumen to do that. It may be possible to gain something in that direction, but not several $100,000 in a short period of time, I don't think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Mike Dewey representing ODS Health Plans. Kerry Barnett, Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, wanted to be here. Unfortunately, he is suffering the flu. He is the former director of DCBS and I think the insurance commissioner, if that's the proper term.
Well, if he's got SARS, don't bring him down.
It's not that, I can assure you. He would be much more eloquent and in terms of the discussion we would have. I understand this is a very difficult issue for you. On the one hand, Dr. Hayden would like to get into the business of being or running an insurance company. On the other hand, you have some significant policy issues that you have to take a look at as to when you get into this business, what are the proper levels? And the debate was had in 2001, and you have the debate now again because somebody can't get to those levels today. And I think that might raise some concerns as to whether or not you can or cannot get to those particular levels. These are tenuous times for insurance companies. At least according to ODS, we see in the dental world utilization up. Therefore, you've got claims experience that may not be in tune actuarially with that. You have the stock market in the tank, and you have investment income going down. And we would say this is not the right time, the right environment to take a different policy choice that you have before you in this particular bill. Now, I think we need to understand when we talk about some previous testimony, at least in the House, Dr. Hayden said, well, these are smaller claims, therefore we don't need the right number, a larger premium. And I would agree with we don't need a larger premium, or excuse me, surplus, but I would assert to you that you need to be very conservative here because, one, we're talking about the number of lives you're covering. If it's 1,000, it's one thing. If it's 50,000, it's another. And if you're off by a couple percentage points in your actuarial, you can go sideways very quickly. At the same time, we're talking about smaller premiums here. If you've got $50 a month for your dental premium and it's $500 for your medical, your utilization has to come in line with your dental because that's what you've collected the premium for, not on the medical side, but on the dental side. So I would say to you, in terms of these policy issues, that who knows what the right number is, but at this point in time, we're talking about a bill that would go from 1.5 million to 850,000. Now, I think that's a significant difference as you start out. And frugality, yes, is important here, but the first 2 years of operating an insurance company are the most difficult years, in our opinion, of operating an insurance company. And so that's why you need to be sure and clear in terms of consumer choice to have a number that protects the public, because the last thing we want to do is have an insurance company go broke. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your opportunity to testify.
Mike, I do have questions. It's my understanding, I want to make this very, very clear for the record here and for the committee, this is asking to enter in the stage in which the original bill allowed the existing companies to progress. So they're not asking to go back to start over again or have the period extended another year for them. They would enter in on the second year of the program at that level and go on from there.
Mr. Chairman, if I can again just clarify, in theory that's correct. In practice, there are no carriers out there who are subject to these transition rules. So it would be creating, in practice, a new category now today.
Well, in reality, it's not, because then I would disagree with you on that, because it made the provision for them to do it. If they chose not to do it, doesn't mean that they couldn't have. And just because one person decided to drop out, and this is a problem I have with the situation that we've got here. We've got big companies in here involved, but we've had several big companies also back out and decide all of a sudden that they don't want to work in these areas. How do we then get somebody else in? Are we going to get some full-blown person from New York with a Donald Trump financial statement that can come in here and start a new company? I don't think so. I think we're going to have to go out probably under those circumstances and allow somebody to come in under a little bit different circumstance. And we're here doing everything we can to try to hold down the costs of our medical and health services. And, I'd have to be a little sympathetic, because I've had to do business for years and in the past against a facility that was maintained by the county at my tax expense, plus it was a facility that I couldn't duplicate in construction style on the acreage in comparison, the parking lot in comparison, and yet I had to turn out and be examined and licensed and certified by the very same people. Not only that, then they took that tax thing and rented it and leased it out to somebody, the sweetheart lease that I couldn't begin to compete with, and we've had to compete with that and been able to do it by superior management and by watching the costs and by treating people in a proper manner. We've been able to stay alive and do a job. And the irony of it is now we're being approached by the group that has operated that have not been able to operate it, and they wanted the successors to us to take it over now and operate it for them. So I'm saying here it may be that ODS will be approaching Mr. Hayden here in the next few years saying, hey, we want to get out of this. We want to hand you our business because we can't make it go, and yet he can do it in a manner because he's not got the overhead. He hasn't saddled himself down with a bunch of stocks and bonds and gone belly up and have to make all of that. And again, if you've got that much, and how can you cut down when you've got to have so many reserves up there? That doesn't mean that you don't have to have high cost to maintain them there either. So I really have some questions, and in my own mind, allowing somebody to enter in a program that we deem fit for anyone else to do, regardless of whether they did it or not, is not a new program.
If I may, Senator Fisher, and I understand where you're coming from in your business, the phase-in, if I may, to go back, made sense because you had companies that were in the business yesterday. And as you phased them in, it would have been unfair to get to a number that was too large for them to swallow. And obviously they could not be competitive if they had to raise premiums because they wouldn't have any clients after a while. So it made sense for them to do that. But this is a new situation now, and this is a law that passed in 2001, and you ought to come under those new particular numbers because that's what the policymakers at the time thought were the appropriate numbers. With regard to ODS, since dental is a major core of their business, I can't imagine that they're looking to sell that component of their business in the near future. So
well,
I want to make that
either, but I mean,
clear on the record. I think your dilemma is, and Dr. Hayden is admirable because he has been trying to protect the people in the Oregon Health Plan from losing those particular services. And I'm involved in that debate in more than one way. And we are going to have people who are going off the Oregon Health Plan from a dental perspective, from a just financial dilemma that you face. But the point is, these are people then that are going to be paying premiums. And this is a significant population that could, in effect, now in the market, paying premiums. At the same time, you just want to make sure that if somebody gets too big too quickly and they go wrong on the actuarial side as they try to compete in this marketplace, and it is a competitive marketplace, there are choices. People are not leaving, as I understand it, are not leaving the dental insurance marketplace. Insurance companies aren't leaving. You have some problems in the medical care for...
Well, we just had an example where you lost 15% basically of your group there when one of seven decided not to continue.
Well, I'm not sure, Senator, how many there are, but I'm saying that employers, in terms of buying insurance or now in the individual marketplace, have choices. But if you bring another 250,000 into the marketplace, we're going to be paying premiums, and you don't have enough money to, you know, from claims. You've got to tap your reserves, and you need to make sure you have substantial reserves to do that.
How many reserves that doesn't stack up that basically even these amounts would protect from a big company making a mistake either? I mean, that'd disappear overnight. So we're not really adequately funded. If we were going to do that, we'd say, well, we need $1 million for the first 50,000, we need $2 million for the second 50,000, and so on up the line. If we were going to make it even remotely even, and I don't know, again, maybe we could ask Cedric, what size are you contemplating? I mean, how many would you be looking to take care of? Or could you conveniently, under your projections, take care of?
Mr. Chairman, I've had 30 years' experience caring for low-income people in the dental field. We've had 10 years' experience under the Oregon Health Plan caring for this population. Before the legislature had to drop the standard, we were caring for 15,000 people. We're currently caring for about 10,000 people. And we are doing that, Mr. Chairman, at a premium which the state pays us of about $20 a month compared to the $50 of the traditional premium. So we do have 10 years experience of caring for low-income dental people. We can insure 10 or 20,000 lives at this low premium. This isn't to say that if we had an insurance company that we would not compete with other companies for the higher premium market too, because we could then use some of that money to care for more poor people.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, you're raising some very good questions, and I think this is a very good public policy debate to have. I just want to offer a couple comments. One, you had suggested that principles and so forth are fine, but when you get into practical difficulties, sometimes you have to figure out a way to solve a problem, and if we had problems in the dental world, we might have to come back and do something different. In my experience in insurance regulation, when you have a company that's already in business and they get into trouble, there's a long history of insurance regulators making all kinds of deals that they said we would never make, but now we're faced with a company that's on the edge and they have to be made. Because of that, because once you have a company in business, and that's the whole origin of this grandfathering in this law, it is very difficult to shut them down. You try to do everything else you can, but precisely because of that point, that's where the compromises typically get made. What you don't want to do, to my knowledge, has never been done here in Oregon, is make compromises on the front end and let people in where you already know it's a little shaky and it's going to be a little difficult. That's where you want to hold the line and then deal with the companies you have when they get into trouble. So that's one. And then the second comment is, you had a very good question, I think, on what happens for companies that build up a lot of volume. The million is a pittance, and it is. And so we have something called risk-based capital that says not only do you need to meet these minimal capital and surplus requirements, but we have the authority and we exercise it all the time to require additional surplus based on volume of business. So the large healthcare service contractors have surplus requirements in some of them in the hundreds of millions of dollars because of the volume of their business. So there is provision in the code to ramp up on these minimal numbers.
Then they would have to meet those too if they started in a new company, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's absolutely correct, yes.
Okay, so you do have some.
We have a way of dealing with volume, yes.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2021. You're welcome. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2021. We're considering the Dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
the Dash 2 amendments.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill, or House Bill 2021. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I will be opposing the bill, but I will approve the Dash 2 amendments. Don't vote to approve.
All right. Thank you. Will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown? Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Farno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morsak?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Brown's excused. I need another motion now for the bill.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
I move Senate Bill 2021 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves that we send Senate Bill or House Bill 2021 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Yes, I'm going to. May I?
Yes, Senator.
I will support the bill. I think I've heard the arguments on both sides. I've very carefully considered the arguments, and what I consider the merits of the bill, I'm voting yes on.
Thank you. Senator Morsak, further comments? Will clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown? Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Farno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morsak?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. Motion carries, and I'll carry the bill. And then with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2021, and we'll adjourn our committee. Thank you for your patience today.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll see you.